Hello and welcome back to Family Law, A Case for Children. When we last met, our discussion was based around the introduction of Christianity in England. But before we move on, I should let you know that although I love history, I am no Dan Jones. However, I will endeavor to be as accurate as I can be with the information I pass on to you. I also will apologize beforehand for the pronunciation of some of the Anglo-Saxon names. That out of the way, shall we move on? During our last discussion, there was no mention of children. This was mainly due to pre-410 AD, that there was no apparatus for extensive writing. And the consequence was little was written, but also that there was no specific Old English word for infant. The monk Alfric translated infant from Latin to Old English, which meant a child without speech. And this begs the question, I believe, that if there is no word for infant, is that telling about how children were treated? Or can it also easily be argued that trying to decipher the lack of existence of a word over 1500 years ago would be cherry-picking moments out of context to further my argument? However, I would argue that the facts speak for themselves. In a society where procreation was not restricted, as far as we know, well, let's compare it to China's one-child policy during 1980 and 2016. As far as we know, this was not the case. So rightly or wrongly so, I believe it goes without saying that for a thing, quote-unquote, that was part of a society, you would have thought that there would have been a word for infant. Nevertheless, our case for children cannot be fairly argued if we do not have sufficient evidence. It will only be conjecture. Just a quick detour here. In the previous episode, I mentioned that the unification arose as a result of Viking raiders, or one of the reasons anyway. But it should be noted that before the unification, which occurred around 929 AD, England was divided into many kingdoms. Those were later reduced to 7 Anglo-Saxon heptarchy. It was Northumbria, Mercia, East Anglia, Essex, Wessex, Kent, and Sussex. The unification of 929 AD brought about the England we know today, with roughly the same boundaries, but due to the multiplicity of kingdoms, there were no standard laws as we know today. The reason I mention that is there's going to be mention of different laws in different areas. I just wanted to let you know that it wasn't standard. It was because it was so divided, it meant that the different kings in the different kingdoms had different laws and it applied in different ways. We will begin our discussion today around the childcare. The idea of the nuclear family is not a modern construct. The father, mother, and children was the core of the Anglo-Saxon society. The idea of the nuclear family would have been more as a result of the times rather than choice. Life expectancy was very low. The Royal College of Physicians of Edinburgh states that while doing an excavation of an Anglo-Saxon cemetery in England, of the 65 burials, the mean age of death was 36, with 48% of skeletons being under the age of 10 years and none over 45. Therefore, I believe it could safely be stated that they did not have the luxury of many grandmas to look after the children. However, kinship was important as it held a number of implications. For example, it's stating your lineage. But one of the things that was very important and integral to the Anglo-Saxon society was fostering. The foster parent role could range from helping the mother, fully adopting a child, or a live-in nanny. The extent to which a child was fostered away from their biological family greatly depended on the status of the family and the age of the child. And whether or not fostering arose due to low life expectancy, no grannies to help, or whether the need proceeded from the simple want of childcare, we are not certain. But what is certain is the part it played in the Anglo-Saxon society. Fostering outside the home, a child would be sent to a relative if a parent or both parents were dead, or for schooling or to learn a skill. A child would be expected to be fostered in a family equal or above his own status. Boys were mainly sent away from home when they were 7 or 8, but it could also be any time in their childhood. Now, there is little information about the fostering of girls. That was mainly due to the extent of which patriarchy was embedded in the fabric of society. However, we do know that girls were given as oblation to the church. In Anglo-Saxon England, it was noted that one of the best ways for caring for a child was to give it to another family. Compare it to our day. Even when it is known that there has been neglect, abuse, or trauma, it is difficult to move a child from its biological parents. But back to the Saxons. Therefore, foster parents were seen as important. When bonds were created outside the nuclear family, it allowed for the children to be protected and cared for at times when life expectancy was low. The bonds created were necessary because as a result, as the adult fostered child, he could call on its foster family to support him in legal or physical battles. Therefore, parents who were able would choose prelates, that is, high-ranking members of the clergy, to look after their children. So, for example, in the medieval times, Henry II's son was sent to be educated by Thomas Becket before the infamous murder. It was through that education that they would make contacts, get trained in the ways of the adult world, but also those contacts would act as extra kin. Due to the care given to the child, there were some loving bonds created. BD in 730 reveals the warmth between a foster boy and his carer, that even after he had grown into an adult, he continued to visit her and would call her mother. Atheling Athelstan remembers his nurse by bequesting her an estate. When children were lovingly cared for by foster parents, it may be that the only emotional sufferers were the parents. However, there is no documentary evidence delving into the emotional effect of fostering on children in Anglo-Saxon England. However, it could easily be summarized that if it was the norm, a child would not feel different if they were fostered. So on the face of things, they would be well adjusted. We can see from one of the laws of King Alfred that issues arose from fostering of children. It stated that if anyone was entrusted his helpless one to another, and that person caused death to his charge, the one who fed him shall clear himself if anyone accuses him. And this seems to relate to when a parent voluntarily gives a child to be fostered. Here, the parents were able to receive redress for abuse. However, where there were no parents due to death, it seems like there would be no redress. Haltheir and Edie, along with the Kentish king Athelbert, made similar provisions with respect to widows and orphans. The implication here was if the mother was living, the child would remain with her, and the estate should be protected and sustained. The emphasis here seems to be on the mothering of the child, and the mother being the right person to care for the child rather than the child being fostered. This may be due to the fact that the father would have been the child's vanguard in case of maltreatment, but the foster by the foster parent. But as he is no longer alive, it is a means of protecting the child and his property. In Wessex, in the 8th century, Law 26 also stated that if a man and a wife had a child, and the man dies, the woman will keep the child and look after the child, and she will be given 6 shillings to look after it, a cow in the summer and an oxen in the winter, and the king's men would look after the property until the child was of age. Although fostering had its problems, laws were made in some circumstances to deal with these issues. Not all fostering were voluntary or due to death. There is a case of a child being removed from the family home by Bishop Wilfrid. He had baptized the child. Due to the fact that the parents were pagans, he forcibly removed him from their care. The intention was that the child would abandon his family and become part of the bishop's household, and this was seen in the surname he gave to the boy, which was Bishopson. When both parents are dead, the child was very vulnerable, as there would be no one to take up their case. And although there were laws about the maintenance of orphans, they were vague, and it is therefore questionable if it had any impact on the welfare of the child. It may also be argued that the laws were not actually meant to protect the vulnerable, but rather to show the piety of a good Christian ruler. In today's society, it would look like a token law that had no teeth. From the discussion, we can conclude that fostering was a way of life in Anglo-Saxon England, and being aware that not all foster homes considered the welfare of the child, laws were enacted to protect them. We can therefore congratulate them for being astute enough to recognize the vulnerability of the children and creating laws to act as a deterrent to bad foster parents. But on a balance of probabilities, I would argue that there is a case to answer, or rather, there was a case to answer. The most vulnerable would be the children without vanguards. The laws enacted were vague or silent on the protection awarded to them or their property. And to my knowledge, there were no laws to deal with situations such as that with Bishop Wilfrid. The power of the clergy could be seen here, alongside with the vulnerability of the children and their parents. But there was no redress. Therefore, I would conclude that those children who were failed, and in Anglo-Saxon England, where there was no social services, NSPCC, or such other charities, they were left to suffer in silence. They, as a society, did not act as reasonable, responsible adults. Next week, we will continue to discuss fostering, but our main focus will be on child oblation. I do hope you will join me then.